and welcome to the Hear It podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Roberts, and I'll be speaking with guests on their campaigns, insights, and ideas to better engage youth audiences. I really hope you like it. This episode of the Hear It podcast, we welcome Bruce Daisley. Bruce previously ran Twitter's business and development across Europe, Middle East and Africa, and is now a writer and consultant on Better Working. If you've not listened to his top business podcast, I'm not quite sure where you've been. It's Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat. And it's a great exploration of workplace culture through a range of perspectives, guests and insight. His books are well worth a read too. The Joy of Work, Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat, and his latest book, Fortitude, which is all about resilience and inner strength, which brings me neatly onto what I'm going to be chatting to him about today. And that's Gen Z in the workplace and progressing workplace cultures for evolving generations. He's also a fellow Midlander. So if I sound extra brummy, I'm going to blame him. Thanks very much for coming on, Bruce.
Thank you so much. I'm so grateful to be here.
So your recent blog, Gen Z Handling Stress at Work, how did that kind of come about?
Yeah, I think the critical thing is that I'm definitely witnessing the fact that if we've witnessed millennials being criticized as the snowflake generation, then Gen Z are being blamed for being even more feeble. And it just feels, firstly, that's a generational trap that every generation falls into, thinking that those who come after them are less hardy and less resilient. But also, I think there's more to it than that. I think that's an unnecessarily simplistic argument that probably is more than a little unfair on younger audiences. So I became sort of fixated with the way that we use the word resilient and how this generational blame that goes at the heart of it, I think.
Why do you think it's so unhelpful for organisations wanting to kind of attract and retain new talent?
There's a curse right now that these identity schisms going on in the workplace. So most senior leaders were the only ones who preferred being in the office 5 days a week. And what you're finding is senior leaders are sort of thinking that everyone else is made from lesser stuff. So to some extent, that is generational blaming or getting frustrated that people don't want to go back to the office as much as they do. And what happens along the way is they ascribe these sort of traits of weakness to different groups. And so it's pretty clear to me that if you look at the way that the modern workplace is shaping up, actually senior leaders have told us for years and years that we needed to embrace change, that, you know, the restructure that we've just had, don't get comfortable, there's going to be another restructure in a year. And actually what we've discovered is that the audiences who are most willing to embrace change are the rest of us. Senior leaders are the ones who seem to be pushing back against change, sort of saying, you know, it would be better if we're in the office 4 days a week, it would be better if this. They're the ones who are reluctant to embrace change. But along the way, I think younger audiences have been credited with things. And I've just written a book about resilience because I was really fixated with how the term has been politicized. A friend of mine works at a North London hospital, and she said, if you mention resilience around here, someone will thump you in the face because, you know, they've gone through 3 years of being short of resources. They've got all manner of problems right now when it comes to dealing with patients. And for someone to say, oh, the problem that they're suffering from isn't a lack of resource, it's a lack of resilience, just seems to be like the most insulting victim blaming to some extent, sort of blaming you for something that's gone wrong. So I think I became fixated with that, really. And, you know, the generational aspect is obviously a really key part of it.
Do you reckon that's a bit of a British thing, this stiff upper lip, you know, let's just, you know, this wartime spirit? It is political, but I think it's used a lot, definitely through the pandemic. And I guess for young generations, it's sort of, oh, well, at least you can go to school and do remotely. I think it's used a bit, like you say, you can't just be resilient. It's not just something you go, okay, oh, now I'm resilient, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, you almost stumbled into sort of what is my key finding there. So the interesting thing is that broadly, as someone said in my research, you can't be resilient on your own, can you? And this is the fundamental thing. So what's happened is that because we ascribe resilience as this individual trait that some people that we've read their autobiography and aren't they resilient? Or we've seen them on TV and aren't they heroically strong? And what you discover is that anytime we actually discover resilience, we witness it, it's because someone is uplifted by the people around them. So, you know, we witnessed resilience in Ukraine, or we witnessed the resilient people who sort of scramble out of a natural disaster. And what you often find is if you hear the testimonies of the people who went through those things, they talk about, like, this democratizing sense of being knocked down. In fact, I was only chatting to someone last week and he was telling me what his dad said to him. His dad had been a schoolboy during the Second World War. He said to him, "What was the war like, Dad?" He said, "I tell you what, son, anyone who went through it would never give it up." Wow, that's a strange thing to say. You would never give up the hardship of being through war. And it's because for the people who went through it, there was this brotherhood of man. There was this sort of this connection that everyone around each other had that was leveling. So you'd hear stories. And, you know, even if you remove the rose tinting, you hear stories of people in the Second World War. They would routinely greet people in the street. They would discuss the situation that was ongoing. There was this sense of community. And as soon as you witness that, as soon as you witness that sort of resilience is the strength we draw from each other, then you struggle to find examples that set apart from it. And I think, in truth, if we schooled, whether it's school children or whether it's people in the workplace, if we said to them, resilience is about a strong sense of support and connection, and if we looked for it in that way, then people wouldn't struggle. I've got a friend of mine, she got sent on a resilience course by her work. I said, "How was it?" She said, "Well, it didn't work. And none of us who went on it said it worked. But the dirty little secret is we can't tell anyone it didn't work because people will think, oh, well, you've had the resilience module loaded into you, so there must be something wrong with you." It's like, you know, we've had Kung Fu loaded into our brains, and if it didn't work, it's not a problem with the Matrix, it's a problem with our brains. And that's the challenge. It sort of, it allows this victim blaming. So whether it's the leaflet stuck to the wall of the North London hospital, or my friend saying that she doesn't feel resilient, broadly, actually, there's an interesting insight that runs through all of it. A guy who came to fix my Wi-Fi, he told me something. He said, "Never in the history of calming down has someone calmed down by being told to calm down." And my feeling is resilience is the same. Never in the history of resilience has someone been resilient because someone said there's a webinar on Wednesday that's going to make you more resilient.
It's a really good point, actually. It just made me think of an article I read last week from Teen Vogue, and it was young people with disabilities or chronic illnesses. And they were saying, so I did a campaign with young people around Paralympic sport and around how campaigns should engage them. And the one thing that was really consistent with that, but also this article I read, was they hate being called, you know, inspirational. You know, "You're so inspirational and like resilient for, you know, all this treatment." And this young person says, "You know, but what choice do I have? I need this treatment. It's not like I go, you know, I'm going to be brave." And you're just doing what you need to do. And I think there's a thing about choice. I think your example of wartime, it's like no one had a choice and go, "Do you know what? I don't really fancy being part of this war." Like you just have to go through it. So it's almost like that's almost forced, in which case you can't make someone resilient by just going, "Here's a course," because it's just something that happens sort of naturally with things around you.
It's interesting you say, you give that example. I was in Beirut when there was this phenomenal explosion 2 years ago. My partner's Lebanese, mad explosion. And on the ground, everyone was like, "Oh, well, look, you know, France is going to help us. America will help us now. Europe will have to help us. Please help, because the economy had collapsed. The poverty was, and the sort of the financial situation was really stark." And so everyone was like, "Well, look, the world will have to help." And instead, all of the coverage around the world was, well done, because the Lebanese people are really resilient. And the people on the ground were like, "Forget about resilient. Stop telling us we're resilient. We just want someone to help us. You know, we've got no choice. What, we don't get up? We've got to get back up. We've got to carry on." And it's similar to your example there with the people who are sort of carrying the burden of disability, is that effectively they've got no choice. And what effectively happens with the resilient word is that it kind of gives us some deniability, some ability to walk away and say, "Good luck with that," you know, because effectively, if you say, "Well, this person's resilient," and if they don't get up, we say, "Well, I'm glad I didn't help them because they weren't resilient enough." Effectively, it sort of gives us some degree of distance. When it comes to young people, really interesting piece of work by one of the world's leading experts of teenage mental well-being, a woman called Jean Twenge, and I'm fixated with her work. She studies sort of how mobile phones have impacted people. And look, she's definitely worth listening to. She says something that's really stark. She says teenagers have gone from being Generation We to Generation Me. And she says, as a result, you know, the connection with phones aren't quite the same. You don't see someone's reaction. You can't necessarily gauge if people heartily believe what they're telling you. And she says, you know, teenagers are spending less time in each other's bedroom than ever before. So one of the unexpected consequences is teenage pregnancies massively fallen. You know, teenage dating is dropped off the charts. But she said something really interesting. She said at the start of the pandemic, rewind the clock to the very start of the pandemic, when teenagers found themselves having a family meal with their mums and dads, or, you know, whichever parent they live with and their siblings, the teenagers who had a family meal each night, their depression went through the floor and their resilience went through the roof. As soon as you recognize that resilience is a sense of feeling connected to the world around us, then it becomes far more helpful, because then you start thinking, okay, well, you know, my dad's not feeling very resilient. And actually, yeah, my dad is pretty isolated. Right, I need to take the lesson. In Australia, they've created these things called men's sheds, recognizing that most men over the age of 40 only have one friend in the world. They've created these things which are just like for retired men that can turn up Thursday morning at this workshop, they have a little workbench and they can work on a project. Now, that's not really the goal. The goal is, like, overtly, it's come and work at this workshop. Covertly, it's come and meet people like you and form these side-by-side friendships that will give you life, that will give you a connection to the world around you. And I think that's the critical thing, knowing that our resilience and our strength comes from feeling plugged into the people around us is such an important insight. And I think it gets lost in this generation blaming or this victim blaming that we're all obsessed with.
Taking that back into the workplace then, so you mentioned some interesting insight into the experience of Gen Z in recent years, so studying remotely, missing out on work placements and graduate schemes, like they were the first to be cut. It's going to take more than, and I know a number of agencies do this, you know, a slide, table tennis, free snacks in the office. It's more than that now that is going to really engage like a new generation of workers, isn't it?
Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, look, critically, I think, you know, you can end up with the smoothie delusion. You can end up thinking, well, look, you know, well, we pressed a smoothie into their hands. Why are they still not motivated? And I think the most critical thing is making people feel connected to those around them. And, you know, sometimes when we think about workplaces, organizations talk about purpose. They sort of say, oh, you know, we've got this real strong sense of purpose about our organization. And I think to some extent that can be a red herring. You know, I've worked in bars where we definitely weren't the best bar on that street. And I've worked in restaurants where most definitely, you know, we weren't, while we were the only few places serving Mexican food in York, it wasn't the best Mexican food this side of Mexico. But when you've got a strong sense of we're all in it together about employees, that even if you're not necessarily got this overarching mission, there is this really strong sense of shared identity. And I think that sometimes is the really critical thing. So let's think about young people joining the workforce. If they feel like, okay, I feel like these people have all got my shared interests, they're all in it together. And I think that's a critical lesson. There's a really interesting bit of a line of research that looks into this. And one piece of work asked people at workplaces, when you talk about the boss, is the boss here a good example of the sort of person who works here? Or when you think about your team, do you think about us or them? Now, the really interesting thing is that the more that people answer in that sort of collective us sense, yeah, the boss is like us, is good represent, good ambassador for us, the more that people talk about those things, their stress levels are lower and their engagement with the job is higher. Now, the challenge right now at work is that, you know, I dialed into one organization during COVID and the big boss was there on the call and a couple of the younger workers were there. The big boss had a grand piano behind him. I mean, it looked like Liberace-esque, it looked like bejeweled. It was like this phenomenal piece of carving and wood. And one of the kids who was dialing in, young 22, looked like he was in the oven. I don't know whether he was in the oven, working from the oven, WFO, but it looked like he was. Now, you've got a real stark sense there, because you're not going to get a strong sense we're all in it together if the boss pulls up in a Ferrari and he's sitting at his grand piano. So trying to evoke that is a really critical detail, I think.
That's really important. I think, you know, I read some insight from Microsoft and it was talking about how Gen Z were, you know, this kind of virtual working, it suits us all very well when we've kind of been in the office with people and got to know them. But if it's your first job and you've just connected with people online, it's actually really challenging to even have the confidence to know how to speak up or read the cues or present. And I think even like in a simple thing like that, like hybrid working, I think if you're going to connect with people or ask them to come in, really using that time in the office so that when they are remote, they do still feel connected. Yeah. I think I've spoken to quite a lot of people going, like, we can't retain talent. And I think one of the big things for lockdown, people really reviewed, like, what is this job then? On paper, what am I actually doing? Because I don't feel connected to it.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's that sense of shared connection. I saw this beautiful thing by the former chief rabbi. He passed away a few years ago, but Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. He was talking specifically about how the culture of Judaism was passed down because, you know, they didn't have the typical things that used to exist. Like, they didn't have buildings or they didn't have places. You know, like, there were people without a place to some extent. And he said, so their culture was passed down by these he called them simha, which is moments of shared joy. And he said, you know, so it meant that because they didn't have these places or these ceremonies that they could draw upon, these moments of shared joy, so weddings, bar mitzvahs, celebrations, became really important for passing culture down and making sure that it evoked a sense of being together. Now, organizations can learn from that, I think. Right now, it means that the stuff that happened accidentally, someone turned up with a Colin the Caterpillar cake on Thursday afternoon because it was Chloe's birthday. The stuff that happened accidentally, great. You're just going to have to plan it a bit more. Are you making sure that people are in the office at the same time? Have they got some degree of overlap? If you and your siblings and your family were all going to mum and dad's for Christmas, but you weren't coordinating which day you were going there, you're not going to get any of the, well, you're not going to get any of the family rows. You're also not going to get the sense of family togetherness. You need to coordinate these things. You need to try and create a sense of shared joy, simha. And I think that's really important for organisations right now.
I love that. And also it's the things that you don't necessarily think about. Like, on paper, what are your simha as an organisation and listing? What are those touch points? There's perhaps some additional considerations that I kind of want to mention to formats of work with the cost of living. And you mentioned it a bit earlier on about different ages may experience that. And I literally spoke to someone last week who was saying, actually, it's going to cost a lot of people, particularly our younger workforce, they're really acutely aware of, it's going to cost me a lot to have my laptops on all day, to heat the house. I'm actually better off. It's more cost effective for me to commute in. It's going to be different per region and all the rest of it. But I think that's going to be something that organisations should take a bit of a lead on to think about how different groups use the office over the winter, isn't it?
Yeah, and look, it's a no win, isn't it? Because, you know, if you're being forced to go in because the thought of having your heating on is more expensive, but you still got to incur the cost of traveling in, then, you know, it demonstrates what a precarious financial situation someone's in to have to navigate that. So, you know, most definitely it's a critical time. And if right now, if you're only building strong culture because people are being forced to come in from the cold, it might make you think about what can you do to try and take advantage of that, of trying to create a shared sense of why people are coming in and what they can benefit from.
You conclude in your blog that many of the issues that impact younger people are just issues that kind of affect all generations, but perhaps Gen Z are more vocal about things like mental health. Do you think we're seeing a new range of skills when it comes to what resilience at work actually means, like vulnerability and openness?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, one of the things I find really stark is that younger generations are admirably less willing to drown their traumas and their personal anxieties in, you know, the bucket loads of booze that previous generations used to. We used to sort of try to just drown out any sense of a dark void inside of us. And younger people seem more in tune with their emotions. We should celebrate that rather than bemoan it. I think, you know, we're getting to a zone where I think we're having more honest discourse. The critical reason why we've got a burnout epidemic is pretty evident, you know, over the course of the last 15 years, when many people in the workforce now won't recognize a time when emails weren't on mobile phones. But, you know, that was 15 years ago. When that first happened, the average working day increased by 2 hours a day. Since the pandemic, the average working day is increased by another 45 minutes a day. So the reason why people are burnt out is because they're working longer than any generation ever did before. Your boss got to his or her position by working in an era where work looked completely different to what it is now. And by people speaking out and saying, this isn't right, that's not a manifestation of them being less hardy, less resilient, having less fortitude. It's more the fact that they're willing to talk about this isn't the right way to do work. And I think the more we have that discussion, the more honest we are about saying to each other, come on, There must be a better way of getting our job done than just being connected to our devices on average for 70 hours a week. There must be a better way of doing it. And I think, you know, if we listen to the younger workers who are saying that this doesn't feel right, I suspect we can navigate to a much better version of work.
Yeah, I think I hear the word naivety a lot mentioned when it comes to youth audiences, but I think you're right, actually, even if it is a naivety of like they haven't experienced the workforce, great, it's a fresh perspective and they can tell you what's up and how that feels to be asked to kind of be on 24/7. Last one from me. So I usually ask guests about any brands or campaigns that they think do a particularly good job at engaging youth audiences. It could be places to work, actually.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, a lot with places to work, a lot of companies are guilty of misdirections. You know, tech firms are very guilty of trying to make out that it's very different working there than it is elsewhere. So I'm always cautious of that. I sort of take that with a pinch of salt. You know, the reason why a load of people in the workforce have got this idea that it's much more sophisticated to work at a technology company is because tech firms have gone out of their way to tell you that. Yeah. You know, having worked at a couple of these places, I can tell you it isn't substantially different to anywhere else you might work. So beware of misdirection there. When I saw this, Dan, and the questions, I really struggled, actually, because I finding it harder to connect or you know, to see any marketing that I think really understands the moment we're in right now. And so I haven't gotten a great answer to this.
Be aware of misdirection is good in terms of place to work. That's a good one. Well, thanks ever so much for coming on today. It's been really great chatting to you.
So lovely to chat. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Hear It podcast. If you like what you heard, please rate, review and subscribe as it really helps others find us. You can also follow us on Twitter @Hear It Podcast or drop us a message by emailing info@threadandfable.com.